Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. I think there'll probably be some empty seats if you guys want to sit. But before I start, I'd like to again thank the APHA Scientific Committee for allowing us to present our work, but also thank Dr. Cargill for keeping us on our toes and organizing this session. So the title of my talk is Care Continuum of HIV-Infected People with Mental Illness in Philadelphia. This study was made in collaboration with the Philadelphia Health Department, the Medical Monitoring Project, and the Penn Mental Health AIDS Research Center. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So HIV and mental illness are closely intertwined conditions, as evident by the high proportion of mental illness among those who are HIV infected, but also the increased risk of HIV acquisition among those who have a history of mental illness. Between 5 to 23% of persons with mental illness are infected with HIV, while the HIV prevalence within the general population is only about 0.3 to 0.4%. As many as half of people living with HIV have one or more psychiatric disorders. So because of these reasons and others, improving the care of people living with HIV and mental illness will be critical to meeting the goals of the U.S. National HIV/AIDS Strategy and accelerating improvements among the HIV care continuum. The National HIV/AIDS Strategy was first released by the White House in July 2010, and it's the first federal comprehensive plan to address the HIV epidemic in the U.S. Its key priorities are to increase access to HIV care, reduce the number of new HIV infections, decrease health disparities, and also improve health outcomes of patients who are infected with HIV. The HIV care continuum, which I'm sure probably most of you are familiar with, consists of making the HIV diagnosis, linking the HIV-positive patient to care, engaging them in care and keeping them retained in care, starting ART and achieving viral suppression. And I think the viral suppression part is what we're all trying to achieve. It's sort of the gold standard. So the HIV care continuum has been used by federal, state, and local agencies to identify gaps in the delivery of healthcare, prioritize and target resources, and monitor goals of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy. Since mental illness affects such a large proportion of people living with HIV, meeting these benchmarks will require us to understand the particular needs of this population. Therefore, those needs cannot be lumped within the general population of HIV-infected patients. So there are many ways in which mental illness affects the care of patients living with HIV. This is just one example showing the association between mortality and mental illness among a cohort of HIV-infected women. So this study used a cohort of 765 HIV-infected women to determine the association between the presence of chronic active depression, which is the bolded dark line, the presence of intermittent depressive symptoms, which is the moderate gray line, and limited or no depressive symptoms, which is the lighter gray line. So the x-axis is time in years, and the y-axis represents the rate of cumulative survival. And as you can see, there is a clear relationship between the presence of active depression and mortality in a dose-related fashion. Women who are chronically depressed are twice as likely to die than women with no active depression. And this relationship remained after controlling for demographic and clinical factors. So the purpose of the study are twofold. One, to compare differences in retention in care, use of ART, and HIV viral suppression between people living with and without mental illness. And we hypothesized that people with a diagnosis of mental illness would have worse outcomes than people without. And the second goal of the study is to help identify gaps in the HIV treatment cascade and then amenable to future intervention. So data was obtained from the Philadelphia Medical Monitoring Project, or MMP, which is a surveillance project funded and coordinated by the CDC. MMP uses a population-based sample representative of people living with HIV to monitor their medical care and make sure that the quality of care that they receive is adequate. We used the Philadelphia 2008, 2009, and 2010 cycles for this study. To be eligible for a study, but also to be part of the MMP cohort, participants have to be HIV positive, 18 years or older, and already enrolled in medical care, and new to the MMP data. So each observation within the cohort is unique. And those eligibility criteria are actually set by the CDC. So our outcome variables consisted of the last three steps of the HIV care continuum, which are retention in care, use of ART, and HIV viral suppression. Our definition of retention in care was based on that of the National HIV/AIDS strategy metric, which defines retention as having two or more medical visits separated by greater than 90 days within a 12-month observation period. Use of ART was defined as having three antiretroviral drugs prescribed at any point during the 12-month period. And viral suppression was defined as having an HIV viral load less than 200 at the last measure of the observation period. Our main exposure variable was diagnosis of mental illness, which was defined as having a documented psychosis, bipolar disorder, anxiety, or depression by medical chart review. Furthermore, we adopted an algorithm published in the literature to classify individuals based on the severity of their mental illness. We coded those with psychosis as having the most severe mental illness, those with bipolar disorder without psychosis as having the next most severe, and those with depression as having the least severe mental illness. We measured the association between demographic, behavioral, and clinical factors with having a mental illness diagnosis. Demographic factors included age, sex, race and ethnicity, and insurance status. Behavioral factors included alcohol abuse and drug abuse, IV drug abuse, and HIV disease severity was measured by the CD4 count level. We use a multivariate logistic regression model to measure these associations. A multivariate logistic regression model was also used to measure the association between mental illness and our outcomes, controlling for behavioral factors, demographic, and clinical factors, which I just described. Our outcomes of interest were retention in HIV care, ART use, and viral suppression. In secondary analyses, we evaluated whether the association between mental illness and our outcomes differed by IV drug abuse status by including an interaction term between mental illness and drug abuse. Similarly, we evaluated whether the association between mental illness or outcomes differed by alcohol abuse status by including an interaction between mental illness and alcohol abuse. In exploratory analyses, the association between increased mental illness severity with our outcomes was evaluated using a regression model controlling for the same factors that I just described. So here are our results. There were a total of 730 people living with HIV. About half of them had a diagnosis of mental illness. Among those, 79% had a diagnosis of depression or anxiety. 12% were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and 9% had a diagnosis of psychosis. On this slide, we present the factors associated with having a diagnosis of mental illness. So women were more likely to have a diagnosis of mental illness compared to men. Blacks were less likely to have a diagnosis of mental illness compared to whites. People on Medicare or Medicaid were more likely to have a diagnosis of mental illness compared to those on private insurance. And those with a history of alcohol or drug abuse were more likely to have a diagnosis of mental illness. Here we present the proportion of people retained using ART and vowelly suppressed by mental illness status. The red represents people with no history of mental illness, and the blue bars represent people with a history of mental illness. The proportion of people retained and on ART were similar, 90 versus 91% for retention, 89 versus 83% for use of ART. However, there was a significant difference for vowel suppression among the two groups. People with a history of depression were less likely to be suppressed compared to those without such history. The vowel suppression rate was 66% among those with a history of mental illness versus 74% in those without. So here we present the results of our multivariate logistic regression showing the relationship between mental illness and our outcomes. So having a mental illness diagnosis was not associated with retention or use of ART. However, people who had such diagnosis were much less likely to be vowelly suppressed compared to those without mental illness. People with older age were more likely to be on ART and vowelly suppressed. Women were less likely to be on ART and to be suppressed. Blacks were less likely to be suppressed. People with higher CD4 counts were more likely to be retained using ART and to be virally suppressed. And there was no relationship between alcohol and drug abuse with our outcomes. So on this slide, we show the relationship between mental illness severity and our outcomes. And as you can see, there's no clear relationship between increased mental illness severity with retention, use of ART, or vowel suppression. And this could maybe be due by the fact that our cell size for those with a history of psychosis and bipolar disorder was really small. But those with a diagnosis of depression or anxiety were about 35% less likely to be vowelly suppressed compared to those without a diagnosis of mental illness. Oops, sorry. Alcohol abuse and IV drug abuse did not significantly modify the association of mental illness with any of the outcomes. So our study has several limitations. MMP does not include a comprehensive evaluation of mental illness. Therefore, our definition of mental illness was restricted to that of which is obtained from the chart abstraction tool. MMP also doesn't collect any treatment history for mental illness. It's very likely that those with treated or untreated mental illness engage in HIV care very differently. Because of limitations with the sampling methods of the MMP data, we were only able to evaluate the last three steps of the HIV care continuum. The impact of mental illness on the earlier steps of the HIV continuum still needs to be determined. We observe high retention rates among those with and without mental illness, and this could also partly be due to the sampling method. Each observation in MMP is limited to 1 year. It would have been interesting to see over time how people with or without a history of mental illness interact in HIV care. So in conclusion, people with a history of HIV commonly experience mental illness. We saw in our sample about half of them had such a diagnosis. People with a diagnosis of mental illness achieve similar rates of retention in HIV care and ART use, but were less likely to be suppressed compared to those without mental illness. I think that these findings argue for the importance of identifying and treating mental illness in people living with HIV to optimize their HIV outcomes, particularly vowel suppression. We need to constantly evaluate models of care which serve our patients the best. I think that there's something to be said about integrating HIV and mental health at one site where providers can address both HIV and mental care together. the relationship between drug and alcohol abuse on ART adherence and vowel suppression needs to be investigated further. In our study, we didn't find an association. And we also need to understand why women do so poorly. Women were more likely to have a diagnosis of mental illness. They were also less likely to be on ART and to be vowelly suppressed. Is it because of untreated mental illness or other factors that we didn't measure in our study? We also review the mortality data among women with depression, which is very compelling. Finally, I'd like to thank our funder and all of our collaborators who made this study possible. Thank you.
So thanks again. I want to echo Dr. Montplaisir. It's really nice to see the room so packed. We were actually worried last night that nobody would come to our session, so it's really nice. Thank you. And I'm going to delve into this. So just in way of disclosure, I will, and it's actually this, I already did it.
Thank you.
She has this timer, so I've got to keep watching it, and she will yank me off. So I have research support. I'm on the Speakers Bureau and consultant for two companies, both Gilead Sciences and Janssen. And just to let you know that nothing in my research will reflect this. It in no way interferes at all. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a little bit of didactic prior to delving into my research, just a little bit on background with HIV and women that I'm not sure everyone is familiar with, then look at the cascade of care for women, and what are the factors that impact that cascade and all along, and I think that will really, at the end when we talk about how to engage, that will really answer some of the questions. And then what I'll do is look at my research. Keep in mind this research is very it's in its early stages. There are many more aspects to go. We actually pulled out over 100 variables, so this is only looking at maybe 10 or 12 that you'll see today, and it's really looking at clinical characteristics and the quality of care for women living with HIV in the United States, and this is really a current data set. So in way of background, there's about 1 million people infected with HIV in the United States, and I think we all know that. About 1/4 of those are women, and I think the next statement is really powerful, for which no accurate data are available. And I'm going to show you that in our data set, and what does that mean? So I think one of the big things we're all looking at the end of that cascade is viral suppression. So everyone knows that we gauge viral suppression, and we look at clinical trials for how to prescribe antiretrovirals. So if you look across clinical trials, women represent about 10 to 15% of those enrolled and Caucasian women. And you're going to see from my data and my demographics that largely the epidemic is made up of non-Hispanic black women. So for me, this data, they're great, robust sets, but really doesn't tell me what they do in the clinic when I look at a woman living with HIV. This also, HIV acquisition among women is correlated with race, poverty, experience of trauma, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit when we talk about how that impacts the cascade, mental illness, substance abuse, and vulnerability to assorted social stigmas. These same factors actually reduce the likelihood of a positive health outcome for these women. So here's looking at the cascade of care we've been talking about all along. And what you can see is, and again, this is going across from left to right, those diagnosed, linked to care, retain the care, prescribed ART, and then finally what we're all looking for to achieve is viral suppression. So this also comes from the data set, and I'm going to explain a little bit about what the medical monitoring project is for those who are unaware. What you can see in orange are females and blue represent males. Numerically, there's a slightly higher percentage along each part until you get to viral suppression. So for example, diagnosed 85% for females, 81% for males. Statistically not significant, but numerically just a little bit higher. But when you get to viral suppression, there's still 26 and 25%. And again, as Dr. Montplaisir mentioned, really this is key viral suppression for many factors, not only morbidity, mortality, transmission, there are many other factors. So this is, we got to figure out how to get more people into this. The other thing I want to draw your attention to is, I think, the first part of the cascade in terms of diagnosis. You know, CDC came out with recommendations in 2006 that everyone should receive a one-time test. That is many, many years ago, and we still have a large fall-off at that initial stage. And all these benefits of antiretrovirals we're losing at that first step. So as you see, as we go down, we have many more ways to go, but I still think we have still not hit that first step. So what factors impact the cascade, and specifically looking at women? These are my sort of what I see in the clinic, and I do have... if I have time, I'll read it, but if not, I'll read it during the question or sort of the interactive part. A letter from a patient that I just received before I came out here that really puts this into perspective in real life. So what are some of the factors that impact the cascade? So first, there are structural ones. Access to care, that's a big one. I mean, everyone knows what Ryan White is. Most of the time when patients fall out of care and they come back in, they say, oh, I lost my insurance from one point or another. They have no idea what Ryan White is, despite being told, being certified. They still feel they cannot access care. Cost, co-pays, transportation, housing, geography, family and work responsibility. These are really critical pieces that prevent people, and especially women, from engaging in the cascade. Provider-patient interactions. Communication is critical. Critical between a provider and a patient. You have to develop that communication and rapport. Cultural norms. Also, a lot of lack of provider expertise. And then finally, discrimination. Yes, in 2014, soon to be 15. Finally, there cannot be a talk on HIV and women without talking about stigma. And whether that's internalized stigma or external stigma, no matter which way you look at, stigma is in there in every part of the cascade. And then finally, a big piece is trauma and violence, whether it's past or present. And what you have to remember is that healthcare and the social service system are sometimes a re-trigger environment for these past traumas or violences. So with that as a background, what we sought to do is look at the characteristics and quality of care for women in the United States. And we presented this last year as an oral presentation at the Women's Workshop in D.C. It changes so much. So in terms of background for what we looked at, we know there are numerous clinical guidelines are available to help assist us provide quality care. For HIV-infected women in care, again, just like I mentioned in the beginning, there are no recent nationally representative samples and estimates of that quality of care or clinical characteristics. Everyone may remember the WISE cohort, but that data is going back now, I'm going to say 14 years, so we have no recent estimates. And finally, it's really vital to establish these estimates and to provide a national benchmark to characterize the patterns of care and then monitor these changes over time. So just what is the medical monitoring project? So it's a national probability sample of HIV-infected persons receiving care in the U.S. I think that part is important. This does not take into account, which is one of the limitations and challenges for those patients who fall out of care. These are patients in care, and we all know there are plenty of patients. I still round in the hospital 5 days a week, and I see a lot of patients who are receiving their primary care in a hospital setting because they're not linked to care. The purpose of this MMP is to describe HIV care and support services being received and the quality of such services, describe the prevalence and occurrence of comorbidities related to the HIV disease, determine prevalence of ongoing risk behaviors and access to the use of prevention services among persons living with HIV, and finally identify met and unmet needs for HIV care and prevention services in order to inform community and care planning groups, healthcare providers, and other stakeholders. So our data set analyzed data from June 2009 to May 2010. Just, again, for those who aren't familiar, there are three components. There is a interview, patient interview, a medical record, data abstraction, and finally they actually do a provider survey. So we actually look to providers that participate in medical monitoring project, and they actually get a survey for themselves. So really it's a robust data set. And for our research, we have data for 1,139 HIV-infected women who represent 114,527 HIV-infected women who received medical care in the U.S. and Puerto Rico, again, from January of 2009 to April 2009. It's the way the data, when you cut the data. This is just showing you where the participating areas, and for anyone who's familiar with the HIV epidemic, it sort of mirrors where the epidemic is. Up and down the Northeast Corridor, the South, and then in the West Coast. So really, it's trying to be representative of those patients living with HIV. So I think it's important to look at the demographics, because again, the last data set looking at demographics of HIV in women were from the WISE cohort many years ago. So 61.5% of non-Hispanic, from our data set, 61.5% were non-Hispanic blacks. 34% had less than a high school education. 10% had been homeless at one point during the study period, and 24% had a lapse in insurance during the study period. I find this one of the worst. 77% had an annual income of less than $19,999. 56% of the women studied had SSI, SSDI, or public assistance as their primary form of income. And 51% had more than 10 years since their HIV diagnosis. And then finally, 65% had a previous diagnosis of AIDS or a CD4 nadir less than or equal to 200. So that sort of sets the background, and then do we really need to ask any more questions when you see that? So I'm going to go through this slowly. There's only a few pieces that we looked at, but I think it's important because, again, they differ where they came from. So first, let's look at antiretroviral use. So part of this was from a face-to-face interview. So when we looked at current antiretroviral use, this was self-report, so they actually asked the patient. So it was 82.7% stated that they were on antiretrovirals. Also keep in mind, in 2009, guidelines were changing for antiretrovirals. So at that point, it was sort of recommended or optional to treat anyone with a CD4 count over 500, as opposed to now. If we looked at this data set now, that should be 100% because it's recommended for all. So guidelines were in transition at this point. So 82.7 does not sound that bad. However, when we went to the medical record, we saw that the most recent viral load being undetectable or less than 200 copies, that was only 66.1%. When we looked at HIV-specific measures, we actually did really good. And again, these two are from the medical record. So CD4 count measured at least twice a year was 86.9%. And if someone had a CD4 count less than 200 or other indicators to start pneumocystis carini prophylaxis, pneumocystis jervecki prophylaxis, I'm sorry, I have to redate myself, it was 81.5%. I expected it to be lower. But, and the last one is, on this side, is clinical services to help people living with HIV remain healthy. So influenza vaccine, again, self-report, 76.1%. I'm going to pause for the second one. I'm going to read the result, and I can actually look in the audience and watch people's faces. Cervical pap smear screening was 77.4%. So this is one of the challenges. Yeah, I see your face, and that's exactly what I said. I disagree with this. So we are trying to go back to the medical record. It's actually really hard because this is not what I see in my clinic at all. This is definitely not. It's much lower. We're in the teens. It's really hard to get. So, again, this was a self-report. So we're trying to see if we can match the two up because, you know, a woman may have come in with something and she had a pelvic exam and she thought it was a pap, and I hear this all the time. So don't be happy with that number. I disagree with it. But it is what it is. So here we get to the badness. I hear from the background. So in terms of screening, and these were documented in the medical record, and two pieces to this. So it was not screening all. We actually screened those who had, you can see number three, they were sexually active. We initially did all, and then we figured, you know what, let's be fair, let's do it for sexually active individuals. And we went back and recalculated. So sexually active refers to persons reporting oral, vaginal, or anal sex during the past 12 months. So those who got gonorrhea screening was 28%, chlamydia 30.3%, and syphilis 49.4%. Again, these are all women. And then this was my baby. I wanted this, and they wanted to kill me because this was so hard to get. But I knew that individuals were not getting the appropriate prevention counseling by a healthcare provider. And again, we looked at it specifically at sexually active women by age. So first we did overall. Overall was 55%, but I was adamant because I knew as you got older, women were not going to get that counseling. So we went back and we pulled painstakingly. And as you can see, 18 to 29 years of age, 67.2% received some form of counseling. 30 to 39 years of age, 60.6. 40 to 49 years of age, 47.3. And then finally, greater than 50, 52.9%. So the numbers went down as you got older. So in conclusion, although the quality of clinical care was high, only 2 out of 3 women were virally suppressed. Most women did receive recommended HIV-specific services, such as adequate CD4 monitoring and PCP prophylaxis. Most women receive clinical services important to help people living with HIV remain healthy, such as influenza vaccine and cervical cancer screening, all with that caveat. And then finally, too few sexually active HIV-infected women received HIV and STI risk reduction counseling, and especially among older women. So the million-dollar question that we hope to answer is, how do we engage women in the cascade, or how do we improve those numbers? Thank you.
Okay. I feel that Dr. Short has not used up all his time, and I think it's very important because when Bill shared this letter that a patient wrote to him about her experience in care, I think it's upsetting enough you should hear it.
Is I was so nervous I wasn't going to get done and she was going to yank me off here. Dear Dr. Short, I need some advice. So in terms of background, this is a patient I originally took care of. She has been on antiretrovirals and suppressed. I've been in practice 12 years, so I want to say about 10. She's never had a detectable viral load. She's one of those patients that's your star. She's been great. She's had two babies with an HIV diagnosis. Both babies are negative. So she moved. Dr. Short, I need some advice. Last month, while at my new OBGYN office seeing, and she lists a doctor, which I will not do, she informed me if my husband and I would be having children soon. I advised her that we would not be having children, yet at this point she informed me that she would have to consult with the medical board to see what ethically needed to be done on her part if I were to pursue having a child. Could I tell you how discouraging I felt when I left that place? She assumed that because I'm positive, my husband is also positive, which he is not. When I corrected her, she said, oh, I really need to get with the board then. I need some advice because I'm uncertain as to what she means or meant. Currently, I'm very confused. Please help me. Thank you.
There you have it, and that's why I felt you needed to hear this, because please don't walk in this room and think in 2014 we don't have to deal with this.
So, good morning. My name is Risha Urban, and I'm pleased to be here this morning to talk about the HIV care cascade and really how we engage black men who have sex with men. I will talk about this topic in the context of HBTN-061, also known as the Brother Study, which is the largest prospective cohort of black MSM in the U.S. During the HBTN-061 study, I served as a scholar at the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and currently I'm a member of the Johns Hopkins HBTN site. I'll be giving this presentation on behalf of the HBTN-061 study team, and we'll highlight important data, lessons learned, and really steps moving forward in how we can all think about engaging the black MSM community. So what we know is that black MSM are in terms of background, black MSM are disproportionately impacted by HIV/AIDS and have higher morbidity and mortality. In particular, black MSM are 3 times more likely to have HIV infected and 6 times more likely to have an undiagnosed HIV infection compared to MSM of other races and ethnicities. However, I think it's really important for us to also note that prior data has really shown that black MSM do not engage in greater levels of high-risk sex as compared to other MSM in other communities. But we think that other factors could potentiate HIV transmission, including lower levels of HIV awareness, of HIV status, and delays accessing clinical services for antiretrovirals. So HIV prevention and care cascade interventions are needed to address the disproportionate burden. For prevention and care cascade interventions to really be successful, public health officials, clinicians, and support service providers need to better understand the contextual factors that are contributing to this concentrated epidemic. And HBTN-061 is a way to help us kind of understand some of those issues. So I want to start off by going through some of the early results released from HBTN-061 at the AIDS 2012 meeting. And then I'll get into some of the subsequent data that came out after that. To give you a little bit of the history of the study, so the purpose of HBTN-061 was really to determine the feasibility and acceptability of a multi-component HIV prevention intervention for black MSM, including peer health and navigation. I'll get into some more of the specifics of the study as we go forward. So the study was conducted in 6 cities, Atlanta, Boston, Los Angeles, New York City, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., between 2009 and 2011. Black MSM were recruited from the community or referred by sexual partners, and participants were offered incentives to refer up to 5 black sexual partners for participation in the study. The eligibility criteria, participants had to be at least 18 years old, identify as a man or male at birth, identified as black, African American, Caribbean, African or multi-ethnic black, and report at least 1 episode of unprotected anal intercourse with a man in the past 6 months. Demographic information was collected by interview, and behavioral assessment was using ACOSI. Social and sexual network questionnaires were completed with the interviewer. Participants were tested for HIV, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis. Participants were provided risk reduction counseling, an offer of services of a peer health navigator to link to clinical and social services, and participants testing positive for any infection were linked to treatment and medical care services. So to understand the study, we had four participant categories. One, HIV uninfected at enrollment. Two, newly HIV infected at enrollment. Three, those with a prior HIV diagnosis but not engaged in care and are having unprotected sex with partners who are uninfected or of unknown HIV status. And then those with a prior HIV diagnosis and in care are only having sex with positive partners, limited to not more than 10 per site. So the design of the study was adopted because the goal was really to obtain a sample of both HIV-infected and uninfected men. Each site had a goal of recruiting about 250 men. HIV uninfected were capped at 200 per site. An enrollment cap of 10 per site was set for those with a prior HIV diagnosis and in care or only having sex with positive partners, since there should be a decreased risk for HIV transmission in this category. So our study population. So we had a little bit over 1,500 men enrolled in the study. Of those, 252 reported either a prior HIV diagnosis or were considered to be previously diagnosed based on testing positive for HIV with a low or undetectable viral load and having antiretrovirals consistent with ART detected on testing. The remaining 1,301 without a prior HIV diagnosis broke down as follows. 38 refused testing or a baseline specimen was not available. 96, or 7.6%, were newly diagnosed with HIV, including three with acute infection, and 1,167 were HIV uninfected. So a little bit about our study population. About a third were 30 years or younger. A little less than 50% had some college education or more. About a third worked full or part-time. 38% had an annual income less than $10,000. And so I think we'll keep seeing this theme of kind of poverty and thinking about the impacts on the care cascade. 3% were transgender, and 30% identified exclusively as gay or homosexual. So I think one of the major points that comes out here is that we have to think about the terminology we use and how we engage people. In our study, only 30% identified as exclusively gay or homosexual, 29% as bisexual, and 42% as other. So this really may signal a need to focus on behaviors and not just sexual identity in Black MSM. Next, I want to touch on one of the subsequent papers that's come out of HVT and 061 led by Ken Mayer, looking at the socioeconomic, behavioral, and biological factors associated with the disproportionate burden. So what this table shows is a comparison of Black MSM found to be newly infected and those who were HIV uninfected. So we found that men who were newly diagnosed with HIV infection compared to those who were HIV uninfected were significantly more likely to engage in unprotected receptive anal intercourse, be unemployed, have at least one HIV-infected partner, and have sexually transmitted infections, and notably less likely to have insufficient income. And I'll touch on this a little bit more later. I think really knowing these characteristics may help us tailor our outreach strategies and interventions, and maybe help us think about how to bundle our services. For example, can employment or trade services be integrated into the healthcare system some way, or can our community-based organizations help play that role? Next, I'll focus on a paper by Sharon Mannheimer, looking at infrequent HIV testing and late diagnosis in Black MSM in our study. So the CDC advises HIV testing every 12 months if risk, and consider every 3 to 6 months in MSM. So our definition we use for infrequent HIV testing was for participants reporting past HIV uninfected or unknown status at enrollment and no HIV testing within the prior 12 months. So the data we obtained, infrequent HIV testing was reported by 21.2% of participants at enrollment, and 12.1% reported never having an HIV test prior to the study. And what I really want to highlight is that infrequent HIV testing was associated with unemployment, not having seen a medical provider in the past 6 months, and high internalized stigma, which speaks to really increasing efforts to effectively link individuals to care to promote testing and the need to develop interventions and public health campaigns to address community stigma, which often leads to internalized HIV stigma. Next, I'll focus briefly on a paper written by Beryl Koblin, Correlates of HIV Acquisition Among Black Men Who Have Sex with Men in 6 U.S. Cities. So our baseline behaviors in the prior 6 months, the median number of biological male partners was 3. Those reporting unprotected anal intercourse, 47% reported receptive, 76% reported insertive. For transactional sex, 29.9% received money or goods, and 16.3% provided money or goods, and 38% reported stimulant use. Again, I think this data can help us to think about how to bundle services in terms of risk reduction counseling, substance abuse counseling, and I think the other large issues that we have to tackle is poverty and unemployment, which has a number of socioeconomic impacts on the HIV and care cascade. So the summary and conclusions of kind of this data is really that in the largest prospective cohort of black MSM, HIV incidence was high, 3%, but in young men, 18 to 30, it was actually 5.9%, which is consistent with what the CDC has reported. Also, young men were also more likely to not have a usual place for health care. So we must have places that individuals feel comfortable and ways to link people effectively to care. I do want to say that these findings do not represent all black MSM in our country. Notably, our cohort was very economically disadvantaged. So the summary and conclusions, we saw that structural, behavioral, and biological factors were associated with undiagnosed HIV infections among black MSM. And what we really need is culturally tailored interventions that encourage repeated HIV and STI testing, engagement with treatment and prevention, and that address social factors such as poverty. So now separately from the data, I'm going to touch on actual peer health navigation. This data has not been published as of yet, but will be soon. This was led by Jermel Wallace, one of our peer health navigators. So lessons learned from peer health navigation. So the preliminary expectation of peer health navigation goals actually differed significantly from what participant-driven goals were, and some of you may have already thought about this. But initially, we theorized that HIV prevention services would be the most common needs. However, participants actually reported needs centered on broader social issues, so housing, employment, immigration status, and drug and alcohol abuse. The other lessons learned were that the most common needs were sometimes the hardest to meet. A lot of this has to do with what resources are available in your area and kind of what the public health infrastructure is. And so sometimes it's very hard to kind of meet some of the kind of social and economic needs that some of our participants needed. Also, those who are in crisis are often those who do not make their peer health navigator appointments. And so we just can't sit in the office, but there will have to be outreach into the community as well. In terms of peer health navigators, we noted that a broad range of experience was really crucial. So different backgrounds and work experiences, really people understanding the community and what resources were available. And so moving forward, things we're thinking about within the context of the HBTN, the kind of broader kind of public health issues as well, really working to overcome homophobia, pushing cultural awareness in the community with providers and institutions. For patients and participants in our studies, really identifying kind of short-term achievable goals, but then also in addition to that, more ambitious kind of long-term goals for people. And then always remembering that we're working within the constraints of the available resources in our area. So to conclude all of this, additional analyses will be conducted to assess the changes in behaviors and uptake of peer health navigation during the study and the relationship to HIV incidence. Targeted, tailored, and culturally appropriate combination HIV prevention packages are urgently needed. And then kind of next steps post HBTN 061. HBTN 063 is actually now running, which is a PrEP demonstration project for black MSM, including client-centered care coordination. And there's a consideration of how we can really address these structural aspects of HIV risk in future studies. For more information, please visit our HBTN site. It contains all the presentations, posters, and publications and press releases. And here are the acknowledgments for our group.
We're going to, like, if we're done for the other ones, we'll have time for two brief questions for Dr. Irvin, and then I'll make my presentation, and then we'll be done. Go ahead.
Thank you.
we've had discussions about that anecdotally, but we haven't done that in an organized way as of yet.
An important point.